So the abridged version on the preface begins with, in the circle of my acquaintance, I've generally been called a deist, the reality of which I've never disputed. But it left out this beautiful first part, which says, in my youth, I was much disposed to contemplation. I just couldn't understand. Of course, this abridgment was done in 1836, so I can't question whoever did it. And also he changed the words. Once I got into comparing the bridge with the original, he had changed around, which actually changed the sense of some of the sentences. So I actually don't recommend the abridged version. If you can stomach the original, it's the best one to read. Although there needs to be another edition of it, because the facsimile edition is hard to read because it has that strange print from the 18th century, you know, which you pick up a little bit of it in the title page, you know, where they show the universe. Yeah. And that's just an odd way of writing an S.
What does he or the other people from the same time period mean by reason?
Yeah, that's a good question. Reason is a faculty of the soul. I'm trying to speak as Ethan would speak here. And it goes along with memory and other faculties of the soul, without which, as he points out, we would be helpless critters because we wouldn't be able to learn from experience. And so reason is derived from our sensations related to the world, but put through the process of reflection. And he believes that we're endowed by the Creator with the faculty of reason. And that's why he trusts it more than anything else, that it's close to the source, as it were, where, actually, he sounds almost like a Buddhist in a certain part where he says there's the mind is but one pure essence. There's only one mind. And that almost sounds like Mahayana Buddhism, exactly. But what is reasonable to me should be reasonable to you as well, because we share the same mind. There's only apparent differences here.
Well, but that would fit the whole concept of the I just lost the phrase. Keep going. It'll come back.
Is that when
Go ahead.
When you talk about reason in that way, is it as opposed to feelings, emotions?
It's opposed to superstition, yeah, for sure. It's what I would liken it to what we call common sense, really. We base common sense on what makes sense to us based on our own experience and what we see other people, you know, acting and conveying. So now, things that are irrational are the bugaboo in the system here, because they lead to, as he puts it, to conditions of misery and vice. For example, you know, if somebody is addicted to something, you know, even if it's money, just making money, that can become an irrational drive. He almost sounds like, again, one of the Greek philosophers, because he feels that contemplation is our highest goal in life, and exemplified in morality, which he, as you pointed out, maybe didn't always embody. You know, he's not putting himself up as an example of all of this. I had the feeling sometime that he was, spoiling for a fight with the reader. Literally, I mean, there's certain books that you read that you have to wrestle with to understand, and this was definitely one of them for me. And I'm not sure I still understand it very well, but I'm really happy I found it when I did, because, as I said, I was looking for something, and in the narrative of his captivity, he has a passage where they were making fun of him in the British prison, and the one of the guards was saying, "What are you? What did you do in your previous life?" And he said, "In my youth," he said, "I studied divinity, but then I became a conjurer." Mm-hmm. That's what he said. And he wrote this. So this is not like the guard reported that he said this. He wrote that about himself. He said, and then I became a conjurer. And they laughed and they said, you sure conjured up that victory at Ticonderoga, because that became absolutely, you know, fable throughout, you know, the American and British worlds. And so, and he laughed and he said, I guess I did. He couldn't conjure up a victory in Montreal, but that was because that was Montreal. You can't surprise a whole city with a band of 80 guys and take it over. I mean, it's just nuts. But he could with Ticonderoga. So I almost felt like this idea of calling himself a conjurer, and then I actually looked it up, and of course conjurer is a magician. Somehow they can pull something out of a hat,
right.
And that's the way he viewed himself. There's a little bit of humor in him. I know he's a braggart and all that, but he could laugh at himself too, I think. Didn't take himself too seriously, I don't think. And I think this also relates to the fact that he really was looking forward to leaving this world. I mean, even though he was quite happy with his second wife, who's the mother of Fanny Allen, Frances Montresor, beautiful, young. She was only like 20, in her early 20s when he married her, and he was in his mid-40s. So he must have had something going for him. I don't know what. But and the only
kinds of romantic stories about that courtship.
Yeah. Yeah, the way he proposed to her, and he said he would get married as long as they didn't have a minister that married them, or something like that. I don't know. She was carried away by him, you might say, because she had a lot of prospects, I think. I mean, coming from a pretty well-to-do family, as I recall, and yet she moved to rustic Vermont, and he built this home, which is very modest. I mean, have you ever visited the Ethan Allen Homestead?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's very modest. And I think that's befitting his philosophy here of avoiding encumbrances.
And the Thoreau-like.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way I may be making more of it. Maybe he's conjuring me up now. I don't know. It gets really kind of spooky. But he worked with freed slaves in the Intervale. Yeah. So that's kind of interesting, too. The whole thing just gets fascinating. And I'm hoping, they're not open yet, but I'm hoping that they will sell this little booklet at the Ethan Allen Homestead, so when people visit there, they can pick this up, and maybe they won't read it on the spot, but get some idea of what he was thinking. Because right now, they do sell the narrative, but that has nothing about his philosophy, and some letters that he wrote. And so I said to Joyce Huff, who is the director there, I said, why don't you have... This is before I even decided to do this. In fact, that's why I decided to do this, because she said, well, there's nothing available that has any of his philosophical writings. And so I said to myself, well, we'll see about that. We'll see what we can do and see if I can come up with something that people, and maybe sell it over at Ticonderoga, too. Obviously, this is not a profit-making enterprise, as my wife points out to me.
That's why we have very wise spouses. They continue to tell us. What I was trying to think of was the collective unconscious.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact, well, and I'm impressed that he married up, which was kind of an, you know, when you think about it, she was well to do money wise, he was well to do land wise.
Well, none of them had a lot of money, I have to say. They had more status than money, because of course money at that time was in transition too. Mm-hmm. You know, when I say that time, this is right after the Revolutionary War.
Yes.
And to tell you the truth, I'm not exactly sure. She, I think, was a widow. Am I right about that? Yeah. And so, and I don't even know, because she was, Corrine Brush was her father-in-law, I think. And he was sort of an enemy of Ethan Allen. I understand that Willard Randall is working on a biography of Ethan Allen, and I'm anxious to talk to him about this to clear up some of the details, because I was more interested in the philosophy than the history, but the history keeps popping up in curious spots.
Now, he was pretty grandiose, so marrying up was not his dream for himself.
Right.
But he turned out, supposedly, a legend has it that he was offered the kingship of Vermont have you heard that legend? When Vermont was a republic, you know, which they just recently mourned our becoming a state. Did you see that on the news?
Yeah.
With Thomas Naylor down there, they brought the coffin of the Republic of Vermont. When Vermont was still a republic, supposedly he was offered something like the kingship or the presidency of the republic, and he turned it down. He just said, no, I don't want that. So he was grandiose, but he had certain... It limits to his ambition. I think
he at one point, and I'm sure you came across this, which I found absolutely fascinating when I read it, thought when Vermont was a republic of attaching it to Canada, and because the Senate, the Congress would not approve statehood for Vermont, and so he was in negotiations with the Brits to become part of Canada.
Right. There is a school of thought that says that he was playing them along, too, that wasn't his goal. But,
but you don't know.
This is what historians love to argue about, though, you know.
But the fact that his mind is so interesting that he would consider doing that. And I think about this insistence on the immortality of the soul and his insistence on reason and common sense and the convolutions that he had to go through to rationally discern the immortality of the soul. You know, it's common sense that if God is perfect and immutable, that this isn't all there is. But I mean, it just seemed implied in that, and it's such it's a leap of faith.
Yeah.
He was influenced by the Bible. I mean, the Bible and the dictionary, and so it's clear in the Bible. So
he knew the Bible. Yeah, I use that quote on the front page, the gods of the... Valley, the gods of the hills, and that's an echo from a biblical passage. And I right now I can't think which book of the Bible it's in. It's in definitely the Old Testament. But he said that down in Albany when they were adjudicating the New Hampshire grants against him. That's right when he became an outlaw, as a matter of fact, because he said he would retreat to the caverns of Vermont and wage war against human nature. He said something like that. Incredible words that this man came out with. And that quote, and of course that quote became the title of an excellent book by Tom Bassett called The Gods of the Hills, which is a history of religion in Vermont, which I highly recommend. It's just a charming book. Yeah. And full of a lot of interesting facts.
Is that the Tom Bassett, member of the Quaker meeting?
Yep. Yeah. Uh-huh. And he talks about the Vermont Creed, and Vermont Creed entailing certain freedom from religion as well as freedom to practice religion and an independent streak, which I've seen tracing back at least to this Ethan Allen work and straight through people like... George Perkins Marsh on environmentalism and John Dewey on education and philosophy. If you read Common Faith, which I've actually mentioned to you guys before, it's almost like a continuation of Reason, the Only Oracle of Man. I mean, you can put the two together, and I actually, it's very enlightening to do that. I don't know for sure that Dewey read it, but I bet he did. I mean, he's a graduate of UVM, and you know, the book was around here. The book was certainly in James Marsh's, George Perkins Marsh's cousins, who was the president of UVM in the 1840s, certainly in his library, and he was known as the father of transcendentalism in New England. Now, we usually think of Emerson and Thoreau but James Marsh was the one who translated the German Enlightenment philosophers into English and caused a whole lot of interest, and in fact, it was known as sort of the Vermont philosophy, believe it or not, back in the early 1840s. And James Marsh was a very popular president, as well as a teacher whose life was short. I guess back in the 18th, 19th century, lives were pretty short. I don't know. He died when he was in his 40s, I think, or thereabouts. But he influenced Emerson, and I brought along Emerson simply because Emerson's always good to bring along. And one of his essays, best essays, is Nature. And I know that you've all read Nature, but it's good to bring it out every now and then. And listen to this in relationship to what Ethan Allen said. And this is just sort of a characteristic passage from Emerson. It seems as if the day was not wholly profane in which we've given heed to some natural object, the fall of snowflakes in the still air, persevering to each crystal in its perfect form, the blowing of sleet over the wide sheet of water, over the plains, the waving of the rye field, mimicking the waving of acres and acres, whose innumerable florets whiten and ripple before the eyes, reflections of the trees and the flowers, and he goes on. But then he says, sitting next to a fire, the crackling and spurting of hemlock in the flames or of pine logs, which yield glory to the walls and faces in the sitting room. These are the music and pictures of the most ancient religion. That's what he says. Now, what is that most ancient religion that Emerson is alluding to here, if not this natural religion which Ethan Allen is talking about here? It's a primordial orientation to nature as a direct revelation from God. And he's saying any day that we can pay heed to some aspect of nature, in other words, pause and just sort of take it in, is not a completely profane day. It has some sacredness in it. And he's saying you're not truly alone if you're sitting in your study and you're working. You need to get out under the stars to be truly alone and to have this kind of communion. It's sort of a natural mysticism, although there's nothing that you could say is truly mystical about Ethan Allen. It comes out more in the Transcendentalist. But I believe, now this is where I'm going to make my own leap of faith, is that the strain of American New England Transcendentalism goes straight back to the Enlightenment. Direct connection, really. And what influenced them, the German idealist philosophers, same ones that influenced Ethan Allen, although indirectly with Ethan Allen, because he wasn't a scholar. And actually, that's what appeals to me about this project, because he's the real deal, you know? He's thought it out in his own mind, yeah, is what he's done. And that's rare, because we're so well-educated by the time we write books. We've read so many books that we're... Yes. I'm always alluding to other authors, you know? He doesn't quote a single author in here, except the Bible. And that kind of direct... And also his confidence, like he says, this is the way it is, and I'll tell you, that's the way it is, you know? No arguments. I just like that kind of... It's almost like a... and he's saying, don't think of this as coming from the Lord in any way. Thus saith mm-hmm. the Lord. This is me saying it. And that's a passage I left out because I thought it was a little too boastful. Sometimes he gets so slightly respectful of tradition. But... they say, the poet says, a joy to be a joy must be shared, and I thought of you guys as somebody that would appreciate this book, because we've had previous discussions, and you sort of know where I'm coming from, and you guys, in a way, pushed me to get this thing done. So I'm not saying I did it just for you, but I did it in part.
Thank
so.
You.
Yeah, because oh, I wanted your opinion on it, and basically, you know, because I am going to improve it. I think it's something I'd like to get other... essays in the back, like I've talked to Frank Bryan, who is kind of a character in himself, about you know, writing a chapter about Ethan Allen in his relationship to Vermont in the way that he embodied. I allude to that where I say he was resurrected in the 19th century mm-hmm. as a superhuman, mm-hmm. and that definitely happened. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking Frank Bryan might have something interesting to say about that. Howard Coffin might have something interesting to say about Ethan Allen as a military guy, because he's sort of a military and a great authority on the Civil War, but also just knows about everything. And then maybe...
Coffin, is he the professor at UVM who left?
Coffin. He's the one that wrote about four or five books on the Civil War and Vermont. Just excellent works. And I happen to know him. I know both these guys. And so I'm going to conjure them up into writing something about Ethan Allen. And then I was going to expand the my comments a little bit on the effect that this book had, just what I was sort of alluding to, on other better-known streams of American thought, like Transcendentalism. Because then bring it all the way down to John Dewey and even down to Jim Jeffords, you know. My Declaration of Independence, I view as sort of related to this.
Related to that. Yeah.
It's a fascinating kind of thing for one little state up here, you know, with a population of 600,000 and a history, you know, that goes back. Yeah. To have this kind of rich intellectual history is, I just think it's phenomenal. And I'm just scratching the surface. I'm by no means
You might want to look at, you know, part of Tom.